Call it.
Call it?
Yes.
For what?
Just call it.
Welcome to episode 133 of Call It Friend, or the podcast where two friends watch two films decided by the flip of a coin. This week, myself, Andy J. Rich, and my co-host, Danica Tiernan, watch two films from legendary Japanese director Akira Kurosawa, 1957's Throne of Blood and 1952's Ikiru. As always, the podcast contains spoilers for the films right from the start. Check out justwatch.com for streaming and rental options in your region. You can find us on Instagram at Call It Friend, or podcast, and we're both on Letterboxd. More about that later. Drop us a line with any feedback or recommendations. Peace.
Are we motherfucking live or what?
I believe we are, if that's a thing. Yes, we are.
Yes, I believe we're live on Sunday or Monday, Zoom. Whenever this comes out.
Is Sunday. This when it's coming out? It comes out, I think Sunday's a good day.
I think Sunday is a good day. Yes, it's the Sabbath day. I always used to like taking a walk and listening to our podcast when it came out on Sunday. So yeah, that'll do me.
That's good. You're the one listener.
There's others. So, two guys messaged me on Letterboxd.
Same. I've been messaged by a horde of people. There's psychos who've gone back through and listened to every episode from the start. Respect to anyone. Respect to anyone who went back to the start and listened to us. I couldn't listen to the first 100 episodes.
No,
gouge my fucking eyes out if I had to listen to episode one again.
The first 50 are tough because I've gone back to movies that I enjoyed when I rewatched them and just gone, what the hell is it? This is nuts.
Yeah. Respect if you can listen to that.
Yeah. But also, respect if you've done more than 100 episodes of a podcast. Respect to you and me, Andy. Yeah, indeed.
Oh, yeah, well done to us. Well done to us. So we've been away for a while. Life kind of got in the way.
Yes.
While we were making plans and stuff.
Way to paraphrase John Lennon.
And we were both engaged in very noble things over the last few months. Okay, yeah, you mine go didn't first. Get what were you doing? Tell me what you were doing over the last 2 months. And we'll just measure up each other's noble's actions. Go ahead.
Oh, no. I'm going to lose. So I wanted to...
We don't know that. We don't know that yet. It's all to play for. Go ahead.
I wanted to gain my driving theory test. I needed some free time in the evenings and something else in my... my wife was very stressed about some things. She doesn't listen to the podcast. I don't mind saying. So I was like, I'll put that on the long finger. The good news is I'm going to take the test next week and I'm pretty sure I'm going to rock it. But that was my reasoning. So there... What was your reasoning, Andy?
Well, over the last few months, I was actually caring for my dad, who was dying of lung cancer. So, and then he passed away last week. So, equally noble, reasons, I think it's fair to say we both.
Yeah, equally noble. That's right. Mm-hmm. The only difference is you finished the job.
Well, so to speak. We'll talk more about that when we get to
it. It would help if you laughed on that. Because now I just sound like a bastard.
no laughing. What is this? Are we supposed to be having fun here? I don't think
so. It is fun. I have missed you. I have missed you.
Yeah, I missed you too.
I don't know. I don't care who knows it. I missed doing the podcast. People have missed doing the podcast, but nowhere near as much as I have missed doing it myself. Because we knew we were coming back, so I shut down any direct talking about film and TV that I've been watching.
Absolutely.
So we could catch up proper and say what we've enjoyed particularly. You want to go first?
Right. So I'm just going to list off everything I've watched in the last 2.5 months. And a lot of this, like, you can find both of our lists basically. Or if you're remotely interested in anything that we've watched, it's all on our Letterboxd accounts. My Letterboxd account is at Andy CIF Pod.
I've changed the name of mine because my previous one was difficult to spell. You can now find me under Fat Tits McMahon.
Is that true?
Yes.
Are you not Donica anymore?
No, I'm now Fat Tits McMahon.
He's not kidding, folks. It's Fat Tits. There's a hyphen. There's a hyphen in Fat Tits. And McMahon is like Vince or Shane.
Yeah, exactly.
MCMAHON. So Fat Tits McMahon. And Andy CIF Pods.
It's a pretty funny name, isn't it?
Straightforward. Yeah, it's CIF. That's funny. Yeah, so okay, here's the list of everything I've seen, and then you can do your list, or no, I'll tell you what, I'll list off mine, and if you have any comments to make, you try and remember what was on the list, and you have any comments, we can discuss. I watched Ferrari at the cinema. Mm-hmm. I rewatched Alien for the 4 millionth time.
Amazing.
I watched Tetris.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you texted me about that.
Yeah, there's none of anything to say about that. Army of Shadows.
Fantastic.
What a great film. What a film. They don't make them like that anymore.
So
definitely
patient.
I need to catch up on some of the other ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just shocking as well that it just wasn't seen for such a long period of time. It fell away to nothing.
Dirty hippies in the 60s, not liking Charles de Gaulle. You know that scene where they do the runaway execution and the one guy
escapes?
That's
exactly what I was just thinking about.
Incredible. Incredible scene. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, Army Shadows is great. Society of the Snow, your favorite film from last year?
Favorite film of last year. I thought it was amazing. I genuinely think it's something else.
I thought it was great. I just wish that I didn't know the story. I wish I hadn't known the story prior to watching it. Because I watched the old Ethan Hawke film back in the 90s.
Me too,
So it's kind of disappointing. I watched Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem.
I saw that. I kind of wish... Why is my question with that? Because I wish I had watched it. But why did you watch it?
I guess mainly for the Reznor and Ross score. That was what attracted me to it.
Is that really what dragged you in? That's mad.
Kind of, yeah. And I thought it's, you know, the art style looks quite good, but it was very much style over substance. There's almost nothing to it. I can't recommend it. Score's good. Score is really good. But I have recently discovered you don't actually need to watch a film to listen to the music from it. It is available in other places, such as Spotify.
Both of our favorite films from last year, I listened to the score probably 100 times before I watched the movie.
Mishima, exactly.
Yeah.
I rewatched Sicario for the 4 millionth time.
I rewatched Sicario recently as well. It's so
even
good.
Better than I remembered it. I watched Ken Burns' The Vietnam War doc series.
Ah, you're just giving me an erection now. That is incredible, is it not?
It was so good. I started it back in 2019. I watched about like 3 episodes back then, and I was like, fucking hell. It's like 18 hours long or something.
But it goes
into so much detail.
It's so
literally everything that you could possibly want to know from like 1850 until now.
I think it's like episode 6 or something. There's this sequence whereby it cuts between an American soldier and a Viet Cong, and they are telling the same story of the same firefight.
The same battle or whatever, yeah.
Incredible. Yeah, yeah. I think it's, despite the fact that, I think I've watched Ken Burns's Civil War doc 3 or 4 times. I don't know. I like it when the good guys lose sometimes, you know? But no. I've watched that like a lot. And that's a joke, by the way. Obviously, the good guys won the Civil War. But I think his grandest achievement is the Vietnam War doc. I think it's an incredible piece of history.
I think what's good about this one is you've got like actual footage from every battle. And it's just a mad thing that they managed to get on camera.
And this goes to show the man's eye for detail. And he's got this kind of status in American film and TV production that he can do stuff like this. It's fucking 3 episodes before the war starts.
Yeah, because they go through the entire history of the country from like 1850.
Which is what you want, quite frankly.
Yeah,
you know?
I did, because I was like, I don't know anything. You know,
it's incredible.
Imagine that I'm a total idiot, and he did that, and he educated me. It was good. What else did I watch? I rewatched Predator for the 4 millionth time.
I did too, because you recommended
it. Even better than it was the 3,999,999th time.
Do you know what? I put it in my Letterboxd review for it, but I'll say it to you now as well. It might just be... No, because I've always been a fan of the movie, but it might also be in aid of... because of that podcast we listened to. But I don't think I ever quite took note of what a great filmmaker McTiernan is. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
Camera movements in that movie are seamless. Like, it's not like people, you compartmentalize it in your mind with other bollocks from the 1980s, let's say. But it's not other bollocks from the 1980s. It's far superior. So many fantastic moments in it.
Yeah.
If you could pick a favorite moment
from Predator, I would say. The final 20 minutes or so. I would say the best of Predator. The final
the best of the Predator.
The final 20 minutes when it's just him versus the Predator. I think I watched like a really high quality version this time.
My version was out the wazoo.
I focused on what was happening a lot more and going like, it's crazy so that it's basically wordless, except for Arnie every so often going like, you boss, you motherfucker, or whatever he's on about.
It's so clever. Anyway, go on.
But yeah, the podcast series you're referring to is Blank Check Podcast.
Credit where it's due. Very good episode.
Doing his career filmography, Mr. John McTiernan currently. What else did I watch? I watched Karen Piri.
Oh, right. I enjoyed the first series of that.
Yeah. I thought it was very good.
It's been renewed.
Has it? Okay. Season one is all that's out. So I watched that, but I was very impressed with that. I thought it handled two different time periods really well and flicking in between the present and past. I thought it worked really well.
And ironically, despite the fact that I enjoyed it, it's kind of the show that ended my love affair with that type of show for a while, because I got very into that kind of BBC murder thing for a while. And actually, but I did really enjoy that, and I'll probably watch the next series.
I'm still there with it. I'm still a fan because that got me to go on and watch season two of Broadchurch, which I did not care for very much.
Okay.
You remember that one with David Tennant and Sophie from
Peep Show?
Yeah,
I've watched the first season.
Season two, would not recommend.
Okay.
It's also from like 2015, but it's the court case of the guy from the first season. Basically, that's the overarching
plot. It's a
bold
move. Let's see, does it work out, Cotton?
It's okay. It's not terrible, but again, it doesn't... I didn't even really care for the first season that much. There's so many really flashy camera moves.
So Broadchurch is bollocks.
Yeah, I wouldn't waste your time with it. It certainly doesn't stand up, in my opinion, to some of the other big ones. But it always surprised me because it's very highly rated. But
I reached a very similar impasse that we'll get into what I've been watching, where I'm like, oh, I'm not going to waste my time anymore. But I'll say that when I get to it. Go on.
So this is it. I'm down to, this last week on Sunday, I rewatched Dune. And then... on Tuesday, I guess it was, I went to the cinema to see Dune 2.
Okay. Will we wait until I get to
yeah,
that?
Yeah. Let's go through yours down. And then we'll talk about Dune 2 because it's the most recent thing I watched.
Outstanding in a field. So the first thing I watched in this year was Poor Things. Mm-hmm. You haven't seen Poor Things.
No.
It's because of the trailer. Yeah, fuck it. Because the trailer looked very, what's the name of the...
Sexy.
No, the director of... It is very sexy. It's a very sexy movie.
Terry Gilliam or someone? It looks very Terry Gilliam to me.
No, the other fella, the French fella, Eternal Sunshine.
Oh, yeah, Michel Gondry.
Yes, I thought it was very Michel Gondry, who for me...
A bit twee?
One would think it can be. And now, to be fair, there's one or two parts in it where they deliberately lean into bad CGI to... falsely recreate a period. I can understand the philosophical decisions for doing so, but it doesn't quite work for me. But overall, the film is fantastic. The film is, it's a if you can imagine such a thing, it's a subtly feminist movie that's entirely successful. Like the concept, and I understand it, like, I really want to read the book now. It was written by a Scottish author in the 1990s.
And then they stripped away all the Scottish parts.
Apparently, yeah. Apparently, there's a controversy about that.
Throne of Blood, just all these things, just appropriating Scottish culture.
Well, there you go. But she's great in it. Ruffalo does great villain. But overall, it's kind of just a series of hilarious, interesting, well-acted adventures. It's not my favorite of his films. It's probably, I don't know, third or fourth. I really like his films, obviously. But I was worried that... To be honest, this has happened to me once before and I was proven wrong. When I saw the trailer for Grand Budapest Hotel, I thought, it's finally happened. Wes Anderson is parodying himself. And it turns out that that's maybe my favorite of his movies. No, it's not, but it's still quite high up. But the same thing happened with Poor Things. I thought this was absolutely fantastic. I watched Mrs. Doubtfire with my daughter.
There's no comment on that.
Lad, that'll break your heart. That shit... I had no idea because I watched Home Alone last year as well and I had a similar reaction. I now think Christopher Columbus just had this habit of making movies that hit children in the perfect way. And like, this is a really serious movie about divorce. Like, you watch it as an adult and it's not accidental. Do you remember the way the plot works out with that?
Yeah, he's trying to break up a successful relationship that his ex is in with a completely normal guy, right?
But this is it. This is how you remember it, and that's how it is. And it's treated like that. The film genuinely treats him as mentally ill. That's the thing. The angle of the picture is, it's in a way you could say it's like an opera for men's rights, basically. Yeah. But
finally,
like, he's a fucking nightmare. The Robin Williams character is a nightmare.
He's playing
and
himself.
Eventually, he sorts himself out by sort of absorbing his feminine side. I was bawling by the end of it.
Andrew Tate videos. He's got a whole different take on the world by then.
I watched Past Lives, which was big but didn't win anything this year. That's a really incredible movie. I would suggest seeking that out. It's slow. It deliberately paced is the nice way to say it. It is a slow movie, but I really really enjoyed it.
How's the score for that? Because I think that's by what's his name, Daniel Rawson, and.
It's really nice. It's actually one of the things that I noted at it. It'll really get you in the feels. But one of the great things about it is it's how would I put it? It's just one of those films I can only explain with real life examples. A few years ago, when a very good friend of mine died, there's a very realistic case to be made that this is mad to say. But bear with me. There's a very realistic case to be made that had I done certain things slightly different in my life, this friend of mine would still be alive. But I'm quite a rational person. I meditate a lot. And I was able to sort of soak in the sadness of the fact that, yeah, that's true. But also, I was always going to live my life this way. So that's just, it is sort of what it is. And that film has a massive, and it, like, they're not romantic about it. They're really caustic and realistic. About it. It's basically two people that knew each other when they were kids and they might have been romantic partners, but they both lived their lives different ways. And eventually they come around to consider that. And one of their lives has turned out miles better than the other, but they just kind of have to reconcile with it. It's not a spoiler, any of this, because if you know anything about it, it's about, and then I guess that's what happens to me. And then you fucking move on. So I thought that was really great. So I rewatched Full Metal Jacket. It's quite a thing. It's still just great, but it's one of those ones that changes as you watch it in years. I rewatched Dune in preparation for the other thing. Okay. I watched Ferrari in the cinema, and I agree with your rating.
I said 3.5, I think.
I gave it 3.5.
I remember saying
it as a movie.
I just didn't care for most of the family stuff, but I loved the big race at the end. Emilia. Which I knew nothing about, so I didn't know
that's
that.
That's the thing, me too.
Tragedy, spoilers for real life.
So what I would say about the film in general is, despite the fact that I'm kind of with you, I didn't care much for the family stuff. I'm there watching it going, I think I texted this to you afterwards. It's like the inverse of most sports movies. Most sports movies are all surface. And he aimed to give you the race in parts, but mostly interested in the person's life, which, like, actually many Michael, like, I'll say this, like any Michael Mann movie that isn't a masterpiece, it's a failed experiment that still has some integrity to it. And this definitely, you couldn't accuse this of not being a well thought out piece of excellent filmmaking. But then that crash sequence is one of the most shocking things I've ever seen in cinema. How they did that, I do not know. It's like slow motion, but it's not slow motion. It's horrific. It's based on a real thing. Have you listened to any interviews with him about the film?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I've listened to other people talking about the film, but not him.
When they went to that area, when they were researching the script, a man came out of the house. He was the toddler who survived the crash. Spoke to Michael Mann.
Well, all that says is about, like, you know, people in Italy just stay in the same place forever, just live in the same family house forever and ever and ever.
Yeah. I mean, and you, like, Both of the deaths in the film are foreshadowed. I don't think either of them are surprising given the way that it's paced out. But it's just, man, I hope he gets to make his Heat movie, his Heat 2 movie before he dies. Yeah, because I read that book. I think it would make a great movie. But again, not his best movie, but still, you couldn't say it's not interesting. Rewatch Predator. I got a good one for you. Real good one. Oh. So occasionally I dip in and out of this Martin Scorsese list he made about best British movies. And some were good, some were bad. But I watched this one called Brief Ecstasy from 1937. It's 66 minutes long. It's about a lady
who has a
fling, and then her flingy moves off to the Far East, and then she ends up shacking up with her professor, and then her old love reappears, and it's about how you deal with it. The plot gets on Hitchcockian levels of tension, but also it's just mad watching a film from 1937 that is essentially about female sexuality. Like, it's crazy, like, because it's unmistakable what it's about. You'd have to be a moron not to notice what the filmmakers are saying. And they made it in 1937. So it's, I don't know.
And female sexuality was only invented in like 1935, I think.
I try 83 in Ireland. Yeah. I watched a miniseries called The English that has been highly acclaimed. And it made me realize that while some stories that are made into films should be miniseries, Napoleon springs to mind, Alexander the Great.
Yeah.
There are some stories that are made into miniseries that should be films.
Is it just about English people being like tall bastards or?
No, no, it's not. The English, it gets its name from the generic name that the Native Americans call all English people. So it's a Western show, by the way. Okay. Starring Emily Blunt, some other famous people in it too. But do you know what? Rafe Spall gives great villain in this. I'll say that. Rafe Spall is right out of a Cormac McCarthy novel in this. Nice. But it just, after episode 3, despite the fact that it is one of them, the last TV show I remember being this beautifully shot was probably Andrew Higgs' The North Water, which I thought was incredible with Colin Farrell on full beast mode. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, but it just, because, you know, like, I love Western movies. I think it's, as a genre of filmmaking, when a Western is pulled off well, it's just pulled off well. But it's as complete as it gets. And this could have been a great movie, but it is not. Do you remember, you know what the inevitable comparison that drew to my mind was? Remember the Better Band guy made that movie, Slow West?
Yeah, I never watched it. Slow West, yeah.
It's really good. Slow West is really good. But it's,
I think I put out for a toss at some point. You'd already seen it anyway.
It jumps back and forth between England at the time and the West at the time, which you don't see enough of that in movies. This does that a bit, but again, goes on a tiny bit too long. It is good, but it's nowhere near as good as people are saying.
Is it just one season then?
They won't be making another. They won't be making another. Watch Pinocchio. No need to go into that. Watch Daisy Miller, Peter Bogdanovich, 1974. Oh, yeah. Broke My Heart. Have you ever seen this?
No, I think it was possibly going to be.
Oh, was it? Did I put it up?
No, I think one of the other films. Who stars in it again? One of the ladies.
What's her chops? Taxi Driver.
Exactly. Jodie Foster? No. Sybil Shepherd. It's Sybil Shepherd.
Sybil Shepherd, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. I think it was in relation to another Sybil Shepherd film. I was going to put that up.
Really good. I would recommend it. 90 minutes and it'll Sounds break good. Your heart. And we're so emotionally dead that this is where we go to you know, get the emotions from. So yeah, Throne of Blood, we'll talk about it in a little bit. Watch Sisu.
Oh yeah,
you heard of this?
Yeah, the Finnish Nazi killing gold guy.
That's really good.
It looks good.
It's really good.
Fun.
I don't.
Is it fun? It looks fun.
You know, it's so fun. That's the thing. Is like, so I really enjoy the first John Wick movie. The other ones, despite the great action sequences, leave me a tiny bit cold because they embrace pure postmodernism. No heart to the story. In the first one, I know you're just rooting for the vengeance of a puppy dog that gets killed. Like, it's the most fucking 2D emotional arc ever. But still, it's there. The other ones don't have anything. This is Nazis trying to steal a Finnish commando's gold. Like, it's just such a perfect setup. And it's executed really well. The Nazis are perfectly Nazi-ish. Women who were part of a Joy Division get to have their own back on some Nazis. It's fun. Yeah. It's a really fun movie. And also, one thing that so many action films do not appreciate these days is that if you escalate from sequence to sequence, it doesn't matter what happens in the last sequence effects-wise. You're there with the character, if you get my meaning. Like, the first one is gunshots, then you got a minefield, then you just got to escalate and change environment. So that's a very, very good example of that. Now, there's another thing I saw called City of the Living Dead, which made me feel like maybe I don't need to see everything that everybody says is important, because it was fucking shite. It's a zombie movie from Italy, which I hated.
I don't really care for zombie films in general.
Fair enough. Maybe you're right. But now, let's talk Dune.
Dune 2.
You go first. On rewatch of the first one, did it get better for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think, because I look back, I rated the first one 3.5 based on just having seen it in the cinema with you.
Day before my wedding.
Oh, yeah. I remember coming out of it and going, yeah, it was fine. It was a bit cold. I don't really care about the plot. It doesn't really have an ending, the first one. Yeah, I noticed that on the rewatch this time. I was like, wow, this really is like a, you know, to be continued in part two.
Yeah.
Which now that part two's out, obviously that completely recasts the first one, where now you're like, well, it's part one of an ongoing story. But rewatching part one this week, I really felt like I was surprised how simple it is. Like, I mean that as, you know, it was easy. It's very clear who everyone is. It's a very simple story to follow. And it just goes like from here, from point A to B to C. Like everything is very simple and clear. And I actually liked it a lot more this time. I gave it an extra half a star, because that's just how generous I am. I got up to 4 stars.
Well, they're
stars.
Both they're 5 and 5 for me, I have to say. I am such a fan of the book and was so looking forward to this movie. I have to admit something. You and I saw this with enemy of the show, John Spillane. Mm-hmm. And I did actually agree with a lot of the points you guys were making, but I was on the defensive about it. So I didn't quite admit that at that time. But this time when I rewatched it, I thought it was absolutely wonderful. I think it's a wonderful film. I think it's got... we're just talking about the first one now for the moment. I think it has more imagination in its fucking pinky finger than... Like, and you know me, I'm an Avatar fan. As far as I'm concerned, shits on Avatar.
Avatar for adults.
Yeah, it's just terrific. Really respects its audience. The design alone is worth the price of admission. But then the score, the action sequence, the attack on Arrakis is, I feel like it's this generation's Lord of the Rings. Like, that's what we're in for. I think this is a trilogy that'll go down in history.
That's exactly my problem with it. That is my biggest problem, is like, I don't like Lord of the Rings. I can watch the Lord of the Rings films and go, I appreciate the filmmaking. I can see what you've done. That's all fantastic. But I don't like fantasy. And watching these two films,
two
like
Dune, sisters,
Dune,
I'm
yeah,
just watching.
Well, that's different. Dune feels like fantasy to me, whereas I prefer like harder science fiction, you know, like
example,
Schindler's List or something like that. Zone of Interest. No, okay. I mean, you know, like the...
Neither of us have seen Zone of Interest, I noticed.
Yeah, I know. That's terrible. I do plan to watch it. I'm trying to think in film terms.
What
Alien,
science fiction
for example?
You like?
Let's put that out there for stars.
Well, okay. I the wonderful thing, like Alien was a bit of a landmark, but it kind of stole the limelight from from what was to be the original landmark in that particular genre, which would have been Dark Star, which was just to bring grubby idiots into science fiction. That's what Alien did in a really, really effective way.
That's who I am.
But this is set 3,000 years in the future. There's heaps of mythology from the books that, you would.
Yeah,
know about
I've
it,
already read through all of the plot things of the books. Like I've read through little summaries of the books and gone, okay, I could see how weird it's going to get, and maybe I'll like that more in a way, but
let's move on to two, though. How did you get on with two?
Well, that was two. Okay, so two, I would say I enjoyed the first 2/3 of it. There's a point, spoilers for Dune 2. There's a point where Chalamet drinks the worm poison thing, blood of life, the lifeblood or whatever the fuck is, water of life. From that point until the end, it kind of lost me a little bit. First of all, I didn't really see.
Oh, I love that.
How did he get down there? How did he get to the south? I didn't even catch. I felt like he just magicked himself there. What did I miss?
No. They wormed all the way down.
He was on a worm by himself, or was he just on a worm?
No. They all traveled down together in like a convoy.
I missed that. I saw the convoy thing where they were all like three of them going off in different directions. I never noticed that Chalamet was on it.
I reread the books just before the first one came out. And so they're books that are written for man children, like often good sci-fi is. It's like the foundation books are exactly the same. The language is so simple. It's meant to be digested by like a teenage brain, but then the ideas are big. And so he executed the ideas with his adult brain visually, Villeneuve. But structurally, it's the exact same as the book. Exactly the same. The first one is not. The second one works in exactly the same way. And what's so fucking... except for one thing, which I think is actually a correction of the biggest flaw in the book. Chani is a conflicted character.
Right. Chani is not in the book. Some kind of problem with him and going like, hey, I don't actually...
With his messianic tendencies.
I don't
tendencies.
Want you to do a massive Holocaust. I think that would be bad.
Which actually ties up with the sequel they're running into, but fair enough. Zendaya would have had a boring role to play if it had been the way it was in the books, I have to say. And I, as huge of a fan of the books I am, it is the truth. But the sequence that you're talking about after that, for example, like, I love the fact that they relied on character to make the climax come off rather than a big smashy action scene. And that actually worked for a film this size, for a single combat fight to work as a climax to the film is quite a thing.
Why did they use swords for their like close combat when they've got guns? Why do they insist on... Is that
the shields, you stupid idiot? Yeah.
Right, well, they never explained that. I just don't remember
a
line.
In the first movie.
Was there a line in the first one where he goes, oh, sometimes we have to use our guns because they've got shields on, just so you remember
no,
that.
No, the guns sometimes use are called las guns. And they can pierce anything. But shield... Oh, God, am I... All right, I'm going to do it.
Yeah, I haven't read the books. Shield,
I read
adult books, so I don't know about this. I don't read any books.
Shields, they stop the movement of electrons.
What about Brooke Shields?
To a certain
pace.
Was
she not?
Exactly. That, I don't know why she wasn't. She invented the shields.
She's the person.
They're named
she
after
made,
her.
Why is she not in it? She could have been going, so I've invented these things and named them after myself. They will protect you. Well, I just want to say this. I want to see space Hamas, free space Palestine. I didn't enjoy it. I didn't enjoy those aspects. I do feel there's going to be some people watching this going like, I should be a massive zealot and I should actually commit horrible crimes in the name of some god.
But you have reminded me of the last thing that I wanted to talk about actually, before we get into the Kurosawas, which is I watched, I completely forgot about it because it's not on my letterbox, but I watched the second series of For All Mankind. And it actually works as a perfect contrast to what I'm talking about with the English, because this is a story that is perfectly suited to TV. So if the setup is the Russians got to the moon first and the space Cold War never ended. So like it really just it drove plot and what. So in second season, the wonderful thing about it is they have their madmen angle. So this is how people were back then, you know? So the characters are really well drawn. It's Ronald D. Moore who did Battlestar Galactica. But then everything that happens in space is so logical that you're like, yeah, that's actually fucking probably how that would have happened. It's like there's guns on the moon, for example, in second season.
I think that's almost finished, is it? Or has it? I think it was like a
two more seasons.
Season
they
arc
say. They want a seven season arc and they're seven seasons in a movie. What's that?
Six seasons in a movie. Community.
Ah, right. Did they actually make the Community movie?
They're planning on it. They just have to get everyone together.
They kicked the funniest character out.
Yeah, Donald Glover. No, I'm just kidding.
Did he get kicked out?
No, he left because he was like, I want to go and do rap and things and make more money.
Chevy Chase was, of course, can we agree that Chevy Chase was the funniest?
He's good. He's good. I rewatched some episodes not that long ago. He is good.
He had my funniest moment in the whole thing when Abed and what's Donald Glover's character's name again?
Troy.
Abed and Troy are pantsing one another and everybody's having a jolly good time with him. They're like, this is the
a woman or something.
He pants his shirt.
Oh, yeah.
What it's the funniest moment in the whole show. I just think particularly it's just so suited to Chevy Chase's personality. And have you ever actually heard the voice messages he left Dan Harmon?
I think so, yeah, a long time ago.
Oh, they're very funny. Anyway, fuck all this bullshit. What did you think of
shit.
Throne of Blood?
Well, this was the second Macbeth adaptation that I watched this week after Dune 2. So I was already getting a bit worn out of the old Macbeth. I'm just saying there were some elements that you could see some crossover there. I thought this was quite hard going. It's 110 minutes.
Boring is the word I'd use.
I like mist. I like horses. I like guys dressed up as samurai.
I wanted to like this so much. It is boring.
It's really highly rated.
Yes, this is the thing. I read half a book about how highly rated it is. I read the BFI essay about it. I have to say, this is a film for people who like Tarkovsky. And maybe I just don't like Tarkovsky. Maybe that's it. There's shots near the end that I found interesting and exciting. I shared some of them on my Instagram. Those are actually pretty nice. And do you know what? The last half an hour is pretty good. The run-up to it, particularly, there's one sequence.
I want to know if you're going to say the same sequence. There's one sequence where he just rides around on his horse for five minutes, going one direction and then the other direction and back.
What is that? What's that about? Is there some poetry to that we're not getting?
He's looking for Spiderweb Castle.
Oh,
the spider is trying to catch himself a couple of flies at Spiderweb Castle.
It's tough going, isn't it?
I think this is... So here's the problem here is like, we know the plot. Because
that's a big problem because
we're cultured, very cultured, so we know our Shakespeare, which is not, this is not even the first version of this film that we've watched.
And this is actually a question that I looked up. This would not have been a known plot to Japanese cinema goers.
Oh,
interesting. In the 50s.
Yeah. Because I mean,
question. Yeah.
Because we know what's going to happen, but it's such a simplified version of that plot because they've boiled down numerous characters into far fewer.
Yeah.
And so, and also I think stripping it, I'm being semi-serious here. I think taking it out of Scotland doesn't work.
You see, so
I think there's elements of this because I think Scotland, I'm not saying that we're the only country that does this, but we have got a lot of backstabbing, nasty bastards.
Well, there's a historical basis to the Scottish story, to the Scottish play, actors
that's
call
right,
it.
You have to call it, being superstitious. You have to do that thing where you twist around and, I don't know,
Blackadder
or something. It's some episode of Blackadder where they say the name and they get in trouble.
But, like, for example, so have you ever seen Shakespeare Live?
Yes. Numerous times. I'm trying to think if I've seen this play.
See, I've seen... I have seen this play live. I've seen, I'd say, four or five Shakespeare plays in my life. And the thing is that good films get... We'll talk about our favorite Shakespeare adaptations in a little bit, but good films get is that Shakespeare is supposed to be...
10 Things I Hate About You.
It's really entertaining to see live. Because once you see the actors get into it, you go... this is where the iambic pentameter comes into it.
It's easy for you to say.
Very good. They're moving with the rhythm of the speech, and there's real choreography to the... It really captures you. And this decides to go the other way in the traditions of... you'll see that I've read a pretentious book about this movie to try and understand it. Yeah, Japanese no theater,
Go ahead.
Go on.
I was going to say, it's acting like Ricky Gervais in Extras when he's on his sitcom that he's doing.
Yes.
And he's like,
I don't really know.
The level of acting for most of the actors, because that's what they did. It was like, you have to show You have to way over the top facial expressions to show how you're feeling and what's happening.
And so let me explain what this Scooby-Doo the BFI level. Book said. Because the thing is, the BFI book had a point, but it made me realize what kind of cinema viewer I were. And by the way, I don't consider this damning of Kurosawa at all, as we'll see when we get to the next movie. But what the book had to say is, so in the filming, there's two different filming styles. There's the static stuff, which represents the no theater. And then whenever it's focused on our Macbeth character, it's much more fluid, much more motion, and it's much more based in reality. And he reckons, and Kurosawa said as much in a couple of interviews, that it's supposed to be a representation of Western individualistic culture coming up against post-imperial Japan, right?
So it's all our fault.
Well, the thing is about it that it made me realize is that I've tried watching Andrei Tarkovsky's films a couple of times, and I thought they were quite boring. And then I read this comment that he made where critics had called his movies boring, and he said, there are only two opinions I care about. One of them is called Renoir, and one of them is called Bresson. And the thing is about Renoir and Bresson's movies is they're actually really good and entertaining and not boring at all. So if you cared about their opinions, you might make yours less boring. And like, and Roger Deakins worships Tarkovsky and stuff like that. I am getting to a point here. But what I'm saying is that's all about the visual poetry. Now, there are, I think I've seen five other Kurosawa films total, and three of them I've watched multiple times. I really, really like Kurosawa's movies. I'm not into this visual poetry style of movie making. I'm just not. My favorite Shakespeare adaptation is Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet. 100%. Hands down. I think he makes Shakespeare fucking kick ass. Another thing I didn't mention, I watched, well, because I didn't finish it, I watched half of Joel Cohen's
The tragedy of Macbeth. Yeah,
way better than this. Way better than this because it has the language. It has the Shakespearean language and soundstages.
Soundstages in studios. I mean, it's. But I like the one that we watched, the Justin Kurzel's.
It's his second best movie, I would say. I think we agreed on that
after Nitram. So yeah, after Nitram. So even this story we've seen redone by other people better.
Boring.
Yeah, you've talked about that. Boring. So like stripping away Scotland or something that looks like, I mean, it's not about Scotland necessarily, but there is genuine history there. There's something to be said for that. And then the language, if you take the language out of the story, what are you left with? Then you're just left with like the bare bones of a plot that you're like, it's not actually that.
A plot that you know.
Yeah, very, very well, because it's like one of the most famous within English-speaking culture.
You can do it if you transform it into a musical. You can do it if you filter it into a high school teen movie. But
one of the adaptations is Scotland, PA, and it's got Christopher Walken in it. It's set, I think it's like a...
This is a joke.
No. Scotland, PA is an American black comedy film from 2001, a modernized retelling. It's reworked.
What would you say is your favorite Shakespearean adaptation?
Of
The Things I Hate About You is a great show, by the way. That is very good. I'm a huge fan of that movie.
It would be something like that. It would either be something where the language is maintained and it's done seriously, or else
Romeo and Juliet?
I remember watching it at school. It was certain, it was fine. I've never been a huge Luhrmann fan, except for his best film, obviously, which we've touched on before, Australia.
Which is now a miniseries.
The greatest film ever made, Australia. Mm-hmm. Apart from that. Yeah, I mean, Shakespeare's not something that, it's not something I rush to of going like, oh, I'd love to see a new filming of a Shakespeare play.
Whenever I get a chance to... This is genuinely true. If ever I get a chance to see Shakespeare that's been given the seal of approval, let's say, like this is a really good version of something, I have gone, because I think it was my first visit to London. There was like £5 tickets to Henry the something or other. And I went in and I thought it was fucking amazing. And it was a real head spinner for me. And I've read, this started a journey. I've read every Shakespeare play. Saying that live, people can quiz me on them if they want. I've read every single one. Some of them are shit. But in my early 20s, I said, okay, I'm going to get this done. I'll read all of them. And so I've seen, let's say, I saw a really good version of King Lear here in Barcelona. In Ireland, I saw Hamlet. Again in London, I saw Richard the What's His Chops.
They all have numbers after them. It's just like Rocky.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. So I think I've understood what's enjoyable about them, and I don't think any of that is present in this. And now, to be fair, I have to. I can't say this strongly enough. Andy, we're wrong because really smart people disagree with us on this.
No.
We must be stupid. But there you go. That's how I feel. I really wanted to like it. I just did not.
I've seen films like Black Knight with Martin Lawrence. I know what I'm talking about. I've seen A Man on a Horse before. I've seen a man take like a popular song from the 70s and then do it using instruments from like the 13th century or something to entertain them. So I know what I'm talking about.
Exactly. I've seen on the week my daughter got born in the hospital, I've seen a suspended NBA player disguise himself as WNBA player in order to still get game time.
Say what you want.
So I know what I'm talking about.
I'd much rather watch that than Throne of Blood.
Joanna Man? Hell yeah.
I would take every day.
Every day. Joanna Man is quite fun.
Joanna Man is a classic, and Kurosawa wishes he could have come up with something like that, but he was wasting his time with this Shakespeare nonsense.
All right. Do we have anything more to say about this?
Well, okay. I mean, there's not much to say about the plot. The way that they simplified it was there's two samurai
Macbeth
guys.
Macbeth happens.
There's two guys. The plot of the Shakespeare play Macbeth takes place. And then at the end, there's some credits right at the end. And they bring it all in 110 minutes. So it's not too bad.
There's some good wide shots. There are some good wide shots.
Taking the three witches down to one witch, I was just kind of like, come on, man. Can you not afford two more actors? You need to have three witches. We can't just have one witch.
They're doing the no thing.
Well, they should be doing the yes and thing.
100% agree.
And I don't like improv.
Speaking of which, actually, did you watch Gillis on SNL?
Yes. I watched some of the. I liked the sketch that got cut.
Yes, that's the funniest sketch.
Emu thing.
You know what the thing is like my head was spinning when reading the journalism about it, but then I heard Shane himself talk about it. Like I thought the whole thing was really funny.
Yeah, he didn't bomb at all.
And then they're all saying this things like Shane Gillis says people aren't laughing, and I remember thinking to myself, I'm sure that's a comedic device. I'm sure that's how people use it. But then actually to hear, because we both listen to his podcast, we know he is as prone to self-hatred as any of us. And when he himself said, no, it went well, I was like, what's the deal? Why did they write all those articles? It's a really strange thing, isn't it?
Some of those articles were already written and ready to post after about the first 2 seconds anyway, so.
Yeah, it's mad. Anyway,
that's why it's always. Anyway, just to say a little bit about two of the cast members.
That's fair.
Chieko Naniwa, who played the witch.
Mm.
We've seen her before. She was in Sancho the Bailiff. She was Ubatake. I think she was the lady who was responsible for the kids at the start. And then she kills herself. Spoilers for Sancho the Bailiff very early on.
She kills her? Oh, she wanders out into the water.
Yeah. Jeez. Not that one. She's like responsible for the two kids at the start.
The mother, you mean?
She's not the mother. She's like a servant or something. I don't know. Okay. I need to listen. I had to Google in the film to find who it is and then find out what the character was.
Why did you recognize her?
No. I just got that from her, her IMDb. But anyway, she worked with Kenji Mizoguchi a couple of times. She was in A Geisha as well.
He's got another film I watched. Not Sancho the Bailiff, but it's also very supernatural. And I have to look.
A lot of the actors in these films, in both of these films, there's a few people that carry over just because.
Yeah.
He tended to work with the same people. The only other person I wanted to mention from Throne of Blood was Isao Kimura, who played like a really, really small part. Well, there's no such thing as small parts. He played the role of Messiah. He played Messenger Phantom. He was a Phantom Messenger. Isao Kimura was born in Hiroshima in 1923.
And wow, so he saw people melting into the pavement.
In 1945, he lost his parents in the atomic bombing, and he himself was exposed to radiation. And
so he was
ended
nearby?
Yeah, and he died in 1958 as a result of cancer. God. Presumably coming from some of his exposure to radiation, at least partially anyway. There's another person in this, Isuzu Yamada, who plays the wife, Lady Asagi Washizu, also known as Lady Macbeth, more accurately. She's in a film called Hiroshima from 1953, which is all
Hiroshima
about the bombing.
Monomore.
It's called Hiroshima. That's it. It's 1953. It's by Hideo Sekigawa. And it's like a fictionalized drama surrounding the bombing. But some of the footage that they used is like real footage from the time. I don't think known or famous, but like popular.
I have lined up to rewatch tonight Oppenheimer. I'm going to rewatch Oppenheimer. And I would just like to say, first of all, it's noteworthy that even on a cutting edge podcast such as Call It Friendo, the Oscars haven't got a mention yet that they might be losing relevancy. But it was very good to see Cillian Murphy and Christopher Nolan win Oscars. I have to say, I was happy to see that. I was happy.
Well, that was my
that.
Pick of the year from last year. I thought it was the best film, and I agree with their choice.
Indeed.
I still have so many films from last year to catch up on.
Me too. Zone of Interest and Anatomy of a Fall coming
up. Anatomy of a Fall, sure. Anyway. They're all available for watching.
Will we move on to Ikiru?
Yeah, let's talk about Ikiru because it's way better.
Man, anybody out there who's looking at the length of this movie and thinking, believe the hype. It's really good. Is it not really good?
It is. It's definitely.
I couldn't believe how good it is.
No, I agree. I'm waiting until we record this episode, and then I'm going to go on to Letterboxd and give it the big old 5 stars.
Ah, you were saving the tension. Thank you. Yeah. I've already given it my 5, as you might have seen. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's a number of things that I would bring up straight away. One note I made when I was watching it is the Spielbergian filmmaking. I was like, no, it's not Spielbergian. It's Kurosawa.
No, he copied off of Spielberg. He did.
The laying of story elements so you pick up on them later. It's totally him. But then there's a couple of other things. First of all, the story itself is so humane that you can't help but sort of dig into it. And then the other thing is, what a surprise. I didn't know this. He dies in the middle of the film.
Yeah.
And then they have a kind of a Socratic debate.
Another 45 minutes about people talking about his life.
And honestly, as good as the first part of the film is, that's the best part of the film for me, is when they're back and forthing about it. I genuinely cried watching this a couple of times. The classic scene particularly, the one that's most famous, him on the swing in the snow.
Him on the swing at the end, yeah.
But I don't know, are people making films like this anymore, in the sense that this is a philosophical idea Socratically explored through this particular medium. It's really something, this movie. It's really brilliant.
I think this is, you know, genius. It's a great, great film. I loved watching it, but I think what really drove home just how good it is I also added onto my list. I didn't mention, I also watched Living, the remake. As well.
Wow.
Yeah. So Living came out in 2022 and it stars Bill Nighy.
Yes.
The science guy. Not really. That's Bill Nighy, guy. I think watching that film just made me realize how good this one is because
it's better, is it?
This is better. I mean, like, Living is stripped away. First of all, so much of this film is about the place and the time. It's 1952. It's 7 years after the end of the Second World War.
Exactly.
The streets are mud. The streets look like absolute dog shit.
Everyone's nihilistic.
Cities have
post-imperial.
Been bombed.
Yeah.
People have served in the Second World War and very importantly have lost the Second World War.
Yeah, yeah.
You've
and
got
are clinging to bureaucracy as meaning.
And which is, you know, from that point until now, has been the exact same thing of you know, people stamping forms with their little Hanko thing that you see in the film. It goes, Hanko, exactly. Hanko, Hanko.
Yeah.
It's like all of that is such a part of the culture of the place and the time. Transporting this to the UK, it doesn't work. It doesn't make sense. It's fine. It's completely fine. But if you've seen the film from 1952, you're like, why would I even bother watching this?
Which because this is an actual philosophical
shorter
exploration.
Yeah. And so to transport it to the UK, you've got, okay, they set it in the same time period. So it's post the Second World War, but you're in a country where, you know, we won the war.
You gained meaning from the war. You didn't lose it.
So people are just walking around going, life is normal. In the scene where they, you know, right at the end where they've all sat around saying like, hey, okay, now that we've understood that he's dead and why he made the park was because he learned he was going to die and he wanted to leave something, you know, like, or make something with his life. And they have that scene where they go, okay, when we go back to work, we're not going to do
that.
We're
all going to be better people.
We're going to be better people. Okay. And the same thing plays out in this, in Living. But at the same point, you're like, they're going to go back to doing what they were doing. But what they're doing is just being fucking lazy. That's all it is. It's British. It's not like, oh, there's this system that we can't overcome. No, it's not that. It's just people being fucking lazy.
You make sounding the rewatch sound like such a valuable exercise in understanding the meaning of the first. Honestly,
I'll tell you what the other thing that I really noticed is like, so in Living, the sport that they flash back to is like a game of cricket, and it lasts literally 5 seconds. His son playing cricket, and he hits the ball and that's it. He goes, oh, well done, son. And then they show the flashback as well of them following the mother, like after the mother's died, they're following her coffin in the car. Again, the scene in Living is only like about 5 seconds or something. It has no weight whatsoever. It's just like they're just pulling some of their favorite scenes from the first film and going like, okay, we're just going to stick these in there.
But that's the thing is like, so I mentioned beforehand, there's the other films that I've seen of him that I loved. Every single one of them I've watched more than once. I've watched Drunken Angel more than once. I've watched Rashomon. I've watched Seven Samurai.
Mm-hmm.
Yojimbo. The High and Low I've watched a couple of times. For me, whatever. Do you know what? It's so acclaimed that I would go to say, I would be okay with saying, maybe I'm the problem. Like Tarkovsky is so acclaimed, I must be the problem. Certain people love it. I don't have that gene in me to love that kind of slow cinematic poetry in a way.
But when you did stand-up comedy, if people didn't like any of your jokes, you would say, I only care about what two people think. Carrot Top and...
Go on. Dick. Carrot Top and Dick.
Who's bad?
No,
Andy Dick. Yeah, that's all. Yeah. Those are the only opinions I care about.
Carrot Top and Andy Dick are the only
Andy Dick's
I care
too
about.
Good. To take that back.
But
sorry,
anyway.
I rudely interrupted.
No worries. Because it's a great film to talk about. It really, really is a great film to talk about.
It is a great film. And to talk about.
Because it just, like, I'd be willing to admit, yeah, I must be the problem with Throne of Blood. But this is what you come to Kurosawa for. This is why those boys worshipped him. This is
5 years earlier than Throne of Blood.
Incredibly entertaining, start to finish. I say it. I was looking at the runtime, going, "Oh boy!" I was glued to this. I was thoroughly engaged, very, very moved. It's a film that's not like it's about something. It's really they started out with a philosophical question to answer with this screenplay, and they successfully do. They really, really successfully do. And the part where he's like, when they're all, by the way, so I don't know, would this have been funny in the same way back in the day? But Japanese guys acting drunk, very funny. That's a very funny category of acting to watch in general. It is good. I'll be very glad to run through a plot so we can talk about specific scenes. So film opens up. This guy's a bureaucrat, Mr. Watanabe. He's got a son. His wife is dead. He lives much like in the Ozu films. It's the Japanese nuclear family situation. He's living with his son and the daughter. He's just
speaking of Ozu, just where you mentioned it, like that's the power of this, is watching this film. It could be anywhere. It speaks to everyone. It's like a completely global experience.
Are you about to say Ozu does not?
No, I was going to say the same, because I think that's what we had established watching, Tokyo Story last year. I think, you could just see the family, the way that the parents and the children interacted with each other. Yeah, it's humane. It's just a human film.
So, yeah, he's there in this bureaucratic job and chucking down pills. And then he goes along to an appointment with the doctor. And this is probably the first part of the film that I really noted the just how good the visual storytelling and how much of an influence it must have had on Spielberg. Is this guy out in the waiting
sat
room?
Sat in the waiting room. He's under like a little arch.
And then
on the other side of the screen, there's like other people waiting and the other
exactly.
part. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Exactly.
It's like a painting.
It's like a painting. And your man saying, yeah, what they tell you when you have stomach cancer is you have an ulcer. So you don't worry about it or whatever. And your man takes all this in and he's like, oh my God, I have this. And eventually he realizes he has stomach cancer. So he makes the decision to kill himself, but he doesn't quite have the. Oh yeah, but actually, first of all,
gets a bunch of drugs.
We meet his son and his daughter-in-law. And they're just all talking about all his money as they enter the house. Nothing. And then they enter to see him in the dark. And they assume, of course, that he's really offended by what they've been saying. And that's the reason he leaves. But no, he doesn't. It's because he's got death on the mind. And this coming up when he goes to get drunk and kill himself is one of the two scenes in the film that made me cry, is when he keeps repeating his son's name and thinking about their life together.
He remembers a baseball match.
Yeah.
His son fucking up at baseball.
Yeah, exactly. And him not being able to connect with him about it. It really, really moved me that bit. And then I saw literally myself in the movie, the insomniac drunken writer in the bar, just being a dickhead, encouraging him to get smashed, which he does. I say I saw myself probably in my early 20s. That's who I probably would have fancied being. And
he does have a fun time. Yeah, they have a fun little time, those two guys.
Until he bums everyone out with that song, Life is Brief.
Yeah. Living has a scene. I mean, basically everything is exactly the same, but another scene that they mimic is when they're going down the tight alleyway and the woman steals his hat.
Yeah.
They're like, the filmmakers were obviously like, we like this scene, but they managed to do it with zero artistry.
There you go. So yeah, they go out on their mad night, so to speak, but it doesn't work out. Watanabe at this point hasn't shown up for work for a week or so, and then this lady who needs to get reform stamps so she can retire goes to his neighborhood. And everybody assumes he's having it off with her, but he's actually just having it off with her youthful energy because he wants to feel something, so to speak. And now, to be fair, Watanabe deserves a lot of credit because many movie characters resort to raping and murdering in order to feel something. He just hangs around with her. But even she, which is actually, do you know what? For a scene set in the 1950s in Japan, this really makes you feel we're all one species. Eventually, the reason they part ways is she gets a bit creeped out by him. She's like,
"It's creepy.
What's
creepy
up
old
with
man
you, man? Why do you
want to hang out?
Do you keep
wanting
to fucking hang out with me?
Go to the cinema with me."
Anyway, she's at this point quit the civil service and started making these little bunny rabbits. And just before she cuts him loose, she says that she likes making the bunny rabbits because she feels like she's playing with all the kids in Japan. And then he gets this brainwave that all these ladies, in your dirty Protestant mind, then he remembers all these ladies wanted to get a park built in their local neighborhood. So he goes back in and he says, oh no, we're going to stir up shit. And then, and this is the script moment. that makes this film like a Socratic argument, we just jump to his funeral. I did not know that was going to happen. Did you?
Yeah, I was like, in another fucking 45 minutes, can we just go the end? He died.
But then
number
he's
out.
Dead and they're all at his funeral.
Have his big
Everyone's
wake.
Being a hypocrite. Yeah. The mayor is being accused of taking credit for Mr. Watanabe's good work. And then while they're at the funeral, they discuss what he had done. And it really becomes a Socratic sequence because they're doing the pros and cons, but explaining them through vignettes. The most effective one, I thought, was the fact that they wanted to put a red light district in and he comes up against the Yakuzas.
Oh, yeah.
But he just... And I think it's really well acted, actually. He's like, he's not afraid at all. Yeah, I think they do that bit really well.
He shouldn't be afraid.
Because they cast the Yakuza quite well. This guy's got nasty scars all on his face and shit. And he's just like, yeah, I'm not quite scared of that. I'm going to build my park. And then, so yada, 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 this Socratic debated back and forth. And then this cop comes in and tells of the sequence, that the most iconic sequence in the film, where he's just... And that's the second part of the film I cried, because it is an incredible moment, that where he's just in the park in the middle of the night, snow raining down,
little swing,
singing his little song. It's beautiful. It's really, really beautiful filmmaking. And so then I was bawling at that. And then the next part of it is the civil servants are all back in the office. And rather beautifully, the one guy who cared the most just disappears underneath his paperwork and they'll just all get along with it. And they'll just do their thing.
That was one of the other problems with living, was the guy who found him dead. It's like a sort of London copper. And he's like, well, Gavna, I found him in the park, didn't I? He was on a swing singing a song.
I'm not
and
going
you're
to
like,
watch
oh,
Living.
God, I wish I didn't speak English right now. Take me to give me the Japanese version, please. Maybe all of this sounds the same. Maybe that's how it sounds like to them. They're like,
maybe.
Then I found him in the park. He was singing a song.
I'm not going to watch the one you watched.
Living is absolutely fine, but it is...
Compared to this?
It's like a photocopy. It's like a Cliff Notes version. It's simplified.
As I've expressed on Letterboxd, to me, this is a 5-star movie. I think
agree. I'm even going to put a little like thing on it, a little love heart. I'm going to give it a little love heart.
I can't believe, I said this already in a text message to enemy of the show, John Spillane. I believe he's watching the film tonight. But I said, Ikiru, believe the hype. I would say that is it is such a really
black and white,
you.
A black and white letterboxed style. It's like a square. I don't know what that is in terms of the measurements, but like you're watching essentially like a black and white square for 2 hours and 40 minutes or something like that. A film that was made in 1952, and literally everyone who was in the film or had anything to do with it has been dead for a long,
20
long
years,
time.
Probably.
Easy. And it is a story that is as relevant now as it was then, in a completely different...
It hits you in the
gutty. This was a completely different world. And still me watching it, you know, just after my dad died also.
Yeah, that's what I was
going
to get to.
It was, he did not have this experience. I'll just say that. He did not go like, I really need to do something with my life, blah, blah. No, he watched like quiz shows until like 2 days before he died. He's watching Lingo.
That's kind of awesome, though, isn't it?
Pointless and stuff like that. Yeah, I mean, he was like, he was locked in. He's like, I'm not going to build a park.
Cut this if you want, but when we had spoken about your dad's terminal illness beforehand, you had mentioned that he was just pure stoic.
Pretty stoic, yeah. Super, super stoic, right until the end.
And
the
did,
one
that,
thing,
did that maintain?
Yeah. But the one thing I would say is that, like, by the very end, like a couple of days, because he never went into hospice or anything like that. He was in the house the entire time. So we were looking
that's
after
good.
Him right until the final day. And about 2 or 3 days before he died, he was basically saying, like, if anyone had to go through this, If anyone who was voting had to go through this, they would 100% vote to like legalize ending your own life. So it made me think about that whole like Stanhope bit, because that Stanhope bit where he talks about how
his mother.
he helped his mother kill herself. Yeah. When I first heard that, I thought that was like really, like a part of me thought it was fucked up of like, you know, like that's a bit out there that he's did this whole bit. But now in retrospect, I think that might have been like the genuinely kinder thing to do. My whole my takeaway from the whole thing is like, I wouldn't want to go through this. Like, I wouldn't want to experience that.
Regards the Stanhope bit, but also I suppose regards your own father, I always objectively felt about that it was right, but I also felt I don't think I would have the courage of my convictions to go through that in real time. And with the, and like, Jesus, this is big, but had your father asked you to do something like that, would you have participated?
No, because I don't want to go to prison. I mean, it was like one of those things where I...
But how did he phrase it?
I should have. He said that he wanted to die. He was very, very clear, not mincing his words or anything like that.
Wow.
Like, give me a ball of morphine or whatever. But like, I think that's the hard... Honestly, the hardest part about the whole thing was not being able to do anything.
Yeah.
Like,
wow.
I there was a couple of days where I was like, this is... Like, I feel bad because I feel like we're more humane to animals than we are to humans. Like,
we are, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, dogs would have been put down in the same situation, you know? So I just think it's like, things are going to change. Things will have to change because I don't think, you know, society can, I don't think we can stand it. I think, you know, there are so many people, we've got an aging population. There's going to reach a point where things are going to switch.
Did he have a good life?
I think so. 82 years old. He lived a lot longer than he ever expected to because his parents died reasonably young and his older sister died in her 60s, maybe.
How did you feel saying goodbye? Did you get to say a proper goodbye?
Not really. I mean, he was like the last week of his life, I'd say the last 4 days, he wasn't really conscious at all. And then the day he died, my mom told me they'd passed and I just put my hand on his head and it was completely freezing cold.
Cold, yeah.
And then I was like, fuck. But after he died, I mean, again, this is like a, you know, we're definitely Scottish. But it was, you know, I don't think any of us wanted to like spend more time with him or anything like that. Like I was like, I would like to get the body out. Like
wakes.
Well, it's more like the feeling of like he was very clearly gone and his body felt like a total empty shell.
Well, you know what a wake is?
Yes. I'm familiar with the concept. It's when Irish people get massively pissed after another one of them has succumbed to their inevitable end.
But you stay up all night with the body.
Yeah, no, fuck that noise. No, thank you.
Fucking dirty prod.
like, get this out of here.
I don't want to be near this. For real though, I'm sure your dad wanted you to host a good movie podcast. No, but no.
He's there. He said, can I be a friend of the show? And I said, you are. You made it. Congrats.
You're a top dude. You're about a million years older than me, so I'll have to deal with this in about a million years myself. But if I...
Well, this is the thing. Everyone will have to deal with this eventually. Yes. And
if
honestly,
I handle it in any way close to you, I'll be pleased with myself because you've clearly worked yourself out well.
I would say it's like one of the best things I've ever done is being able to care for my dad. And I'm very, very happy that I got the opportunity to do it. Like
that's really beautiful.
Yeah, honestly, I think it's like, it's one of those things where it makes you feel better. It makes you feel better about yourself and also about them. Like you get closer and you know, it's the point
of the whole thing. It's the final level thing. Like, that's the thing is, no matter what people say, there are functions to having kids, but certainly a part of it is you'll have people to...
There's someone to look after. Please look after me, please.
Exactly. You'll have people to look after you when you get older. And like that sounds like a perfectly pathetic thing, but it's also the natural order of humanity, us raised above the beasts. Like that is one of the hallmarks of it. And you've gone through it.
we weren't close. We weren't particularly close during his life, but I think there's something that kicks in where you're like, okay, no, I mean, this is like, this is my parent, this is my dad, and like, you, I wanted to be here to look after him. Like, it's just, it's just something, it's, there's something in there. I don't know why it is. It's like, I don't know, stronger than anything.
It's Catholic God.
It must be.
Yeah.
It's definitely that. It's God.
I don't know how he got into your head. It must have been a mistake.
I don't know, because I've been sober, so my Catholic God travels through alcohol.
Must be all your time in Italy.
It's that. It's definitely that. Yeah.
Anyway, shall we toss?
Yeah. As a mark of respect, let's get the coin. I've got one. I swear I'm not digging around in my undercarriage.
Arsehole.
It's here. Yeah, I got one. It's, look, it's right here. It's a 2P or not 2P. Okay.
It's better than any line in Throne of Blood, what you just said right there.
Thank you. That was written by a guy called Bill S.
All right. By the way, what was your dad's name?
Ian.
Ian. All right. Ian Ritchie. Rest in peace.
R.I.P.
All right. So what are you bringing to the table, fucker?
Well, I've gone for a 1978 film called The Silent Partner, starring Elliot Gould and Christopher Plummer. It's written by Curtis Hanson.
Yes, I saw that.
Confidential and stuff.
Although whatever. We'll see if you win. I hope you do.
Yeah, because I'd never heard of that, but it looks good.
It looks really good. Yeah.
However, I have heard of your film.
Yeah, yeah. Joe Dante's prequel to James Cameron's debut movie, Piranha.
I like to pronounce it Piranha.
Ah, very good.
I'm never going to say it like that ever again.
I hope not.
Would you like heads or tails?
Give us heads.
Come on, Dad. Don't let me down. Well, that fucked up. There is no God.
You down. Catholic God is no longer smiling in the Ritchie clan.
Fuck Catholic gods.
How dare you? He's listening on my mic.
I meant that in a nice way. The coin has literally disappeared. I'm not kidding.
Shall I?
No.
All right, be stubborn.
It's gone. It's gone. There's been a miracle.
That's your dad.
I'm not even kidding. The coin is not here.
I mean, we could just decide it in favor of Silent Witness.
I think we have to, because there's no coin. Okay, I'm going to get another coin. No, I'm going to get another coin. Let's do it.
Okay.
Okay, here we go. Let's try that again.
Heads?
Wait. Tails.
Ah, shit. But oh, great.
But oh, thank God.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So what might I have won?
Well, you were going to win a Joe Dante film that we've talked about before, which we've both seen. It's not Gremlins. It was going to be The Burbs. I wanted to rewatch The Burbs.
Ah, that would have been a good week.
It would have been a good old fun time. But no.
What the week we're about to do is going to be better. We're going to do an Elliot Gould, late 1970s double bill, Capricorn 1.
Okay.
Do you know anything about Capricorn
again?
1?
I don't think so. Is it sci-fi?
It looks so fun. Yeah, it kind of, it's like sci-fi / 70s conspiracy thriller.
Mm. Oh, yeah. I think I heard a bit about that recently.
About the fake moon landing. And fake Mars landing. Yeah,
is it
Sam Waterston?
Oh, okay, no. I was wrong. I thought it was, what's his name? Hyams. Pierre Hyams or something. But no.
Who knows? Anyway, I'm looking forward to it. That sounds like a great week for movies, quite frankly. Piranha, yeah, Burbs would have been good too, but whatever. Let's stay on the right track. Let's stay away from the Thrones of Blood going forward. You and I like to be entertained at least once
a week.
That's
right.
Yeah. From now on, you have my solemn oath. If we land into some pretentious moving painting territory, it was by accident.
Fair play.
All right. Good. Nothing to say, but I'll see you next week, and I love you.
I love you too.
Bye.